the slammer, the joint, the pokey, hooscow, lockup, clink, jail. On Mind's Eye Radio, we'll take a look at the Soviet Union through the eyes of an American visitor, visit a home for delinquent girls where anger and resentment rule. And we'll share the incarceration of the artist. Stay tuned for Doing Time on Mind's Eye Radio. The slammer, the joint, the pokey, hooscow, lockup, clink, cooler, stir, calaboose, workhouse. Just some of the words we use to describe facilities that confine those who commit crimes and must then pay their debts to society. Jail. For most of us, it's a frightening prospect. Being locked up and guarded 24 hours a day for months, even years on end, would seem an overwhelming deterrent. Yet, thousands of individuals each year are tried and sentenced to prison terms and serve time. During the next hour, the Mind's Eye Radio Collective will offer some observations on doing time, whether in state-sponsored facilities or self-imposed prisons. I'm Greg Willard, your host. Stay tuned for Doing Time on Mind's Eye Radio. During this hour, we'll take a look at the Soviet Union through the eyes of an American visitor during the time the old system was on its deathbed. We'll visit a home for delinquent girls where anger and resentment rule. And we'll share the incarceration of the artist, dedicated to a calling that makes extraordinary demands upon its servants. We hope to make it a liberating experience, so don't go away. In Dick Radke's story, Field Trip, a fifth grade class is subjected to a first-hand glimpse of what it's like to live in a cell. That kind of episode would be a sobering experience for young minds, wouldn't it? The scene is rendered for us by Kerry Wire.
Things got wild in our school this year. All kinds of mayhem. After Gerardo got beat up in the boys' washroom, Vice Principal Stanley said, "This stuff's gotta stop." Then followed a big meeting between Mr. Stanley and Officer Black to see what could be done from keeping us kids from turning bad, like the boys who beat up Gerardo. Next day, Vice Principal Stanley came into fifth grade and announced a field trip and passed out permission slips for our parents to sign. Tuesday, we scrambled aboard the school bus, the boys pushing and shoving for seats in the back, and us girls up front. Just before the driver closed the door, Mr. Stanley came aboard and told us this trip would be a good lesson for some of the rascals who make trouble. On the way, Anthony B. and Nathan L. opened their window and made pig noises at cars passing by. After a while, the bus came to a huge building with big white columns. When we were all out of the bus and smushed together on the sidewalk, Mrs. Robinson said, "Students, today we're going to visit the county penal facility and learn what happens to people who flout the law." Marcus and Anthony B. snickered and elbowed each other when Mrs. Robinson said, "Penal facility," and Marcus shoved me from behind. He is so immature. Inside, Mrs. Robinson told us to follow Deputy Wendt. Deputy Wendt hitched his belt and gave Anthony B. the evil eye. We went down the hall to a small room where two men in uniform sat at a metal table. Behind them was a door with one small window. Deputy Wendt told us, "The men inside figured the law didn't apply to them. They set out to rob the honest people of our county, thinking they could get away with it. As we'll see when I unlock this door, they were wrong." Deputy Wendt hitched his belt up again. "Before we go in, I'd like you to form two lines. Keep your hands and arms to yourself. Do not go near the cells. These are dangerous criminals. Speak only to me, not to the prisoners." There was a general nodding of heads and a loud buzzing sound before Deputy Wendt swung the heavy door open like a bank vault. On the other side was a long hallway, stretching clear to the end of the building. On both sides of the hallway were heavy iron bars. And behind the bars were men in bright orange coveralls, two to a cell. I was afraid to go in. I grabbed Naomi by the hand and held her back, letting some of the other kids go first. As they did, the men in orange began to gather at the cell bars, some taking hold of the iron and looking at our class like we were the ones on display. As Naomi and I followed along behind, a kind of general hubbub arose among the kids who had gone in first. Jason Cullen called out, and then Anthony B., As I passed through the big metal doorway, I saw why. There was Jason's uncle, Jerry, who had been arrested for stealing cars off the lot of Monarch Motors. In the cell with him was Butch Michaels, our local lock and key man. Further on down was Devante Swoop's father, who was waiting trial for bad checks. Devante was happy to see him. Which was also true when Rayana Brown's father called her from the furthermost cell in the block, and she ran down to say hello. Everybody soon forgot Deputy Wendt's orders to stay away from the cells, for most everybody in the class saw somebody in jail that they knew. Deputy Wendt and Mrs. Robinson tried to calm things down without much result. I saw our neighbor Nicholas Schatzberg sitting on his bed and smoking. When I called out to him, he smiled at me and said, "Hey, Jermaine, how's it going?" By this time, Deputy Wendt was moving kids back out of the cell block, and soon Naomi and me joined the rest in the small outer room, where Mrs. Robinson gave us holy bejesus for not following instructions. I'd had enough of jails. Too cramped, too crowded, and those orange suits. No way would I be caught wearing one of those things. That was pretty much the end of our field trip. We marched down the hall and went out to the school bus. Deputy Wendt said that the moral of the story is that it's better to stick to the straight and narrow. Or whatever. As we made our way down the aisle of the bus, Jason Cullen tried to trip Rayana and steal her purse. She was too quick for him, though, and smacked him a good one in the back. Next week, the fifth grade is going on a field trip to the Moth Museum. This is Carrie Wire from Mind's Eye Radio.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Norma Gay Pruitt remembers a time in her checkered past when even she had a brush with the long arm of the law. While Pruitt never spent time in the pokey, she did spend an hour or two in the station house one night as a teenager. Over time, the experience has assumed the epic dimensions of an Edward G. Robinson prison movie. And oh yeah, Pruitt claims the episode was all her sister's fault.
The lockup in the town where I grew up looks just like the one in Mayberry RFD, right down to the checkered tablecloth. When I lived there, we even had an Otis-type repeat offender, though the cops never bothered to lock him up because the only time they tried to hold an evildoer in our cell, he kicked his way out through the side of the building. The only thing the village elders ever did hold there was meetings by a pot-bellied stove. And it's still where people go to vote in this town of 300 souls. So you might say I've been a tad sheltered in this matter of incarceration. Though I've never spent a New York minute in the pokey, nor don't know nothing no-how about the hoosegow, never seen the inside of a lockup, talk trash to a screw, or so on, there was this one incident my sister got me into. That time, I begged to be incarcerated. Brrrum, brrrum. The scene is Lake, oh, never mind, a border city between Illinois, where I lived, and Wisconsin, where drinking started at age 18, and the time is summer, the 4th of July. Lake, oh, never mind, was notorious and glorious. My sis and her college friends had been stuck babysitting for me or something and decided to take a bender to Lake whatever, so I got to go too. They had actually been being served all night when I grew tired of being plunked on a bar stool and abandoned. So I wandered outside looking for my sister and her friends. I couldn't find them, but I found the car, a battered white Studebaker, so I climbed in. Soon enough, some boys showed up, probably underagers themselves, but toting a six-pack, which they proceeded to stash under the car and polish off bottle by bottle while we flirted. But nobody was getting lucky that Independence Day. As I sat smiling goofily, my boy buddies vanished, having radared the policeman descending on the Studebaker. They split, of course, and left me literally holding the bag. I seem to recall being read my rights as I tripped down a long flight of steps. Since I didn't know what else to do with me, and since I was not actually in a bar at the time, they hauled me in. At the station, the gum-chewing matron who sat filing her clawish nails was straight out of central casting. I immediately became Betty Davis, or my 16-year-old Lycra stretch stirrup-panted version. I smoked then, and that helped the effect I was after. Let's call this film noir Lust for Freedom. Though the whole scene took place in the rather pleasant office of the police station, I remember it like this. Hey, turnkey, jailer, I'm rotting away in here. You better take my shoelaces and belt. I'm feeling desperation coming on.
Pipe down, you. You've only been in stir 15 minutes. Criminally. You know you can only rattle the bars with a tin cup, not that plastic. What an amateur.
I want to talk to a lawyer. You're railroading me. I've never given it up. Word.
Don't be stupid. All you did was have a couple of beers. This is Wisconsin. It's a breakfast of champions around here. What does word mean?
I don't know, but everybody will be saying it in 30 years. Hey, are you calling me out? You can torture me, but I'll never spill my guts. I'm no stoolie. They won't call me a snitch.
You spilled your guts in the parking lot. And you ratted your sister out all the way to the station. Now, can I get you the phone?
Why? So I can hang myself with the cord? So you can say it was a simple accident? Maybe like Hurricane Carter? Joey? Huh? Huh?
So you can call your daddy and mommy and get the hell out of my jail. I got kids enough of my own to make me crazy.
You just wish, don't you? No, I'm going to do my time straight up and end to end.
Fine. I'll give you a choice. You prefer jail?
You bet your Maybelline I do.
You can stay in jail, or you can call your folks.
I'm staying in this flea-breeding dump.
We're calling your folks.
So that's how my dear, long-suffering father, a strict non-drinker, and my fearsome brother-in-law, also a teetotaler, drove up to Lake O'Deer in the middle of the night and bailed me out. To Dad's credit, he never said another word about the incident, maybe knowing just what that sword hanging over my head would do to my future dabblings in criminality. My sister, on the other hand, never quit catching flack. However, now that I think of it, she's never seen the inside of the big house either, so maybe the movie has a moral. And if I ever catch my boy sneaking around trying to drink underage, why, I'll... This is Norma Gay, Muggsy Pruitt, saying, let me into here!
If I hadn't spent the night in jail, I would have been at the restaurant with you. I used my one phone call, but to no avail, your line was busy, so what could I do? You were probably talking to your sister again. You two always have a lot to say. Anyway, if I hadn't spent the night in jail, we could have danced the night away. We could have danced the night away if I hadn't stopped off at that bar. But it looked like it might be the perfect place to sell some of those stolen VCRs. How was I to know that's where the cops hang out? And they'd heard a sales pitch like mine before. If I hadn't stopped off at that bar, I would not have slept on the jailhouse floor. If I hadn't slept on the jailhouse floor, you and I could have had a night of fun. If only I'd come knocking, knocking on your door, not selling VCRs to a detective with a gun. Then you wouldn't be down here today, counting out the money for my bail. You and I could have had a night of fun if I hadn't spent the night in jail. If I hadn't spent the night in jail. If I hadn't spent the night in jail. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
A prison affects the attitudes and behavior not just of those incarcerated there, but also the minds and bodies of those assigned to guard the prisoners. Mind's Eye writer Paul Thompson discovered that one of his forebears served as a guard at a Civil War prison camp and tried to capture the experience in letters to his family back home. Thompson helps us understand what it was like.
It was a spring night in 1865. My great-grandfather, John Thompson, was writing his family from Johnson Island in Lake Erie, where he helped guard some 2,600 Confederate officers captured by Union forces. He had volunteered for the Union Army at age 39, leaving behind a wife and seven children back on the family farm in Pennsylvania. But he fought only one battle before falling ill with malaria and eventually being posted to serve on Johnson Island. Now, 2 years later, he wrote his family,
"The band is playing its lively airs, and the whole world seems alight with life, light, and gladness."
The prison camp staff was still celebrating the week-old news of Lee's surrender in Virginia.
"There is a candle burning in every pane of each window on the island, and the city of Sandusky across the bay is very highly illuminated. The boys have just returned with a likeness of Jeff Davis on a pole. Jeff looked a little as I used to think the devil looked, and the wild cheering of the boys was a little ahead of anything of the kind I ever heard. The firecrackers are bursting everywhere and sound not a little unlike the musketry of the battlefield when one is a little distant from the scene of the action. Large bonfires are burning in all directions."
There was obviously no cheering from the Confederate prisoners housed in two-story wooden barracks on 15 acres of grass. When the prison was first occupied, the prisoners were fairly well treated. They ate the same food as the guards: fresh beef, baker's bread, sugar, coffee, beans, and hominy. But accustomed to a southern climate, they suffered in the cold winters, even though each barracks had a wood stove and each prisoner was furnished with blankets. A lieutenant from Mississippi later wrote, "On the night of January 1st, 1864, the thermometer went down to 21 degrees below zero. He would have frozen to death had not two officers from Arkansas loaned him quilts." In 1864, prison rations were progressively reduced in retaliation for alleged mistreatment of Union men held in Confederate prison camps. The men grew gaunt and caught rats to supplement their diet. The water supplies were contaminated from the latrines, although authorities were not aware of this. Many of the officers were already ill and malnourished when captured. Despite the best care of the medical staff, These conditions gradually filled up the camp's little graveyard. John Thompson found the island depressing, and he himself remained in ill health. Now, as the war seemed close to ending, a fit of shaking and fever forced him to discontinue writing to his family until 2 days later. When he resumed, he had other news to report. The island was mourning the assassination of President Lincoln.
Please find enclosed the little newspaper extra that came over to us yesterday. Not that I expect it will convey any news to you, but that by it you may know how the saddening, sickening news came to us. On receipt of this, the flags were lowered and hung at half-mast, and the air being quite still, they waved but droopingly, seeming to conform most appropriately to the feelings of the admirers of the bravest and most noble and best man that ever trod American soil or breathed the air of any clime.
Here a chill forced John Thompson to break off again, but he resumed writing the next day.
President A. Lincoln partook of so much of the goodness of God that in view I had almost forgotten that there was a God above him. The big, hot, blistering tears of grief and sorrow have frequently deterred me from writing you on this painful subject.
He told his family that the prisoners felt the loss as well, for they had counted on Lincoln not to pursue vengeance against the rebels.
Cole said that the assassination of A. Lincoln would be the cause of his death. He had based all his hopes on the leniency of the president, but now he considers that his fate is sealed and death is his certain doom. One of the reb officers told one of our lieutenants that they had lost the best friend that they had in view of the settlement of the difficulties now existing between the North and South, for he said he believed that the president would deal impartially with them, and that he would not let passion and prejudice overrule justice in the final settlement. But now, he being assassinated, the full penalty of the law would fall upon them.
But there was no retribution. With the end of the war, the rebel officers were released. My great-grandfather was discharged. He went home, dug up the jug of whiskey he had buried in his yard against his return, and polished it off. But in a curious way, he remained a prisoner of Johnson Island himself. His health remained fragile, and he was often depressed. Unable to farm, he turned to practicing homeopathic medicine and became much respected among his farm neighbors for his remedies. A quarter century later, his body and mind both worn out, he drowned himself in the mill stream. He had at last escaped Johnson Island. This is Paul Thompson.
And Dick Radke.
For Mind's Eye Radio.
Our show today on Mind's Eye Radio is Doin' Time. I'm Greg Willard. Stay with us and we'll take a look inside a girls' detention center. That's next on Mind's Eye Radio.
I don't mind being in jail, but I gotta stay there so long. I don't mind. Every friend I've had done shook hands and gone. Better stop your man from tickling me under my chin. Tickling me under my chin. If he keeps on tickling, I'm gonna lick him on in.
For most of us, jail conjures up images of hardened male criminals in a harsh setting of cells and armed guards. But writer Evie Thompson shows us that criminal acts and antisocial behavior are neither gender nor age specific. In her story, Trapped, Thompson explores the atmosphere and the dangers of a visit to a school for delinquent girls.
I push the doorbell of the two-story limestone dormitory. The wind presses against my back, and the cold settles in around my collar. In the spring, when the plum trees on the hillside bloom, the dorms in the high school look like a fancy girls' school. Now, with the snow and gaunt trees, it looks like what it is, a school for delinquent girls. There's a loud, rasping buzz as the door clicks open. The hallway is empty. Having buzzed me in, the matron has gone off to the kitchen at the back of the building, where she supervises the preparations for lunch at this time of day. I slip off my coat and leave it in the matron's office. Then I move quickly along the short space of hallway and through the French doors into the common room, closing the doors behind me. 7 girls sit on the settees in occasional chairs, some talking, some just staring into space. This building houses girls who are too disruptive to live in the other dormitories. Some are about to be sent to an adult prison or mental institution. Others are just coming back, now being given a second chance. None are judged stable enough to be in the regular high school classes. And because they need help to keep from falling too far behind with their studies, I was recruited to teach here for 2 hours a day, in addition to my history and English classes in the high school. I like working with delinquent girls. Having grown up in a rough neighborhood, I know the kind of environment they've had to face, and I know the strength and courage that takes. 3 of the girls were in my classes at the high school, Dolores, Amy, and June. The others I'm just coming to know. In the 2 weeks I've been here, they've all made some progress, and on the whole, I think they all rather like me, but at the same time, I'm not trained to do this kind of teaching. It's a lot like a one-room school, with each of the students following a different path. So I just don't feel very sure of myself. I set most of the girls to work doing the written assignments from their textbooks or on mimeograph sheets sent over by their teachers in the high school. Then I sit down with Dolores at a small wood table in the middle of the room and begin the remedial work. All of her life, Dolores has had to live with a learning disability, and at 14, her reading and math are way below grade level. What makes it harder for us both, though, is that Dolores is a reluctant student. In the neighborhood where she grew up, a hot temper and an intimidating presence would almost always carry the day, so she's learned there are better ways of getting what you want than academic success. Faced with multiplication flashcards, Dolores' small, puffy face strains and hardens. 3 times 4. Come on, Dolores. You can do it. Dolores squints. Time passes. It seems as difficult for her as if she had to slog through knee-deep mud. You can do it. You just did it on the previous round. I can't! You can't make me! Dolores' face seems swollen as her eyes dart back and forth. Come on, Dolores. Just one more try. Dolores leaps from her chair and backs away from the table. Her face turns red. Suddenly, I'm standing. All of the girls are standing. The room is very still. You bitch! You come in here telling us what to do! Dolores grabs a metal ashtray and hurls it at me. I duck, and it clangs against the wall. The blood pounds in my ears. Dolores, I'm sorry I pressed so hard. Could we just sit down? You can take a few minutes to collect yourself, and we won't do multiplication anymore this morning. Dolores, her head thrust forward, steps toward me. I'm not going to sit down. I'm not going to do anything you say, you b-. The other girls move in closer, too. My back is up against the table. I am surrounded. Someone to the right says, "You think you're so much better than we are. Yeah, always coming in here and telling us what we should be doing." I glance at the closed French doors. Beyond them, a long hallway leads to the kitchen. Even if I shout with all my might, the matron will never hear me. I feel the girls gathering themselves, working themselves up. Someone shoves me. Instinctively, I raise my arms to defend myself. Then there is a knock on the French door. It swings open. The school nurse stands in the doorway, her coat still on. "What is going on here?" The girls fall back. Seeing the opening, I move quickly through them, past the school nurse and on into the matron's office. In the background, I hear the nurse saying, "I came to give June her shot. But what on earth is going on?" There is a clamor of angry, complaining voices. I feel a little safer seated behind the matron's desk facing the door. Some of the tension eases out of me. But then Amy darts into the room, leans across the desk and yells, "You I'm going to tell matron about you!" She dashes back out the door and off toward the kitchen. I feel a moment of relief. Then I start thinking about the knives stored in the kitchen. How long would it take Amy to get back with one? The room feels cold. A gust of wind rattles the window. I pick up the phone and dial security. I have a terribly strong urge to close and lock the door to the office, but that seems too cowardly. So I sit and wait for the security men. This is Ebby Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Americans are inclined to take their freedom for granted. Living in a relatively free society, we expect to move about as we wish, without fear of unwarranted scrutiny by the authorities. Citizens of other countries are not always so fortunate, as Guy Thorvaldsen found some years ago when he visited Russia as a citizen diplomat.
Since September 11th, the critical issue of freedom has reemerged in Americans' consciousness, which I think, though brought about by tragedy, is a good thing. My own awakening about freedom came 14 years ago when I became a citizen diplomat, in specific, working directly with the Russians as they ran the treacherous gauntlet of perestroika, endeavoring to unlock the prison doors of their own government. At that time, I was an expatriate, living in an international community in the Scottish Highlands. Our fly-by-the-seat-of-our-pants diplomatic strategy was to first establish working relationships with Russian individuals or groups, focusing on the areas of environment, community, and spirituality. Then, 10 or so of us would fly into Russia under the guise of participating in a 10-day tour. After arriving and passing through the glare of customs, we would, according to regulations, check in at a state-sanctioned hotel. But within hours, we'd abandon the tour and spend our time living on the run, visiting and living in people's homes, hearing their stories, and finding ways in which we might support their work. Often this support extended to sponsoring these new friends to visit the West, at that time a legal prerequisite to leaving Russia. Even then, despite perestroika, this sponsorship was a delicate business, rife with red tape. It felt good to do this work, meaningful, like I was promoting world peace in tangible ways, saving people from some ignoble fascist existence, or so I thought. One bitter cold November day, while visiting a youth center in Novgorod, a small city 300 kilometers southwest of Moscow, and noted as the place where the German incursion in World War II was finally halted, I met a bright young woman named Svetlana, who invited a Scottish friend and I to visit her family home on the outskirts of the city. The invitation was for 6 o'clock, and we accepted, but then I proceeded to put my foot firmly in my mouth. One of the challenges of visiting Russia without a tour guide was that we often went long stretches without a meal. Restaurants were almost impossible to find, and food shops meant standing on long lines, which, if we were lucky, might result in purchasing an unlabeled rusty tin of something that, once opened, was often still hard to identify. So I was often hungry, and knowing that the visit to Svetlana's might last, as many visits did, 5 or 6 hours, drinking only tea and vodka, I innocently asked, "For dinner?" I did this simply to know if I should find a meal before I came. Svetlana's enthusiastic smile quickly disappeared, and a tide of panic spread across her face. "Diner," she said haltingly. "Diner." "Da, diner, okay." Immediately I knew I had blown it. Her family, who like any other Russian family pride themselves on the magnanimity of their hosting, would most likely spend the next 5 hours scrambling on the black market to accommodate us, in the process spending precious savings. Unfortunately, Svetlana would not accept my subsequent retractions, and when my friend and I arrived, sure enough, Svetlana's family's table was full, and her parents appeared haggard and exhausted from their efforts. Luckily, later in the evening, Svetlana unknowingly offered me a chance to redeem myself. She shyly asked if I wouldn't mind speaking on the phone to a friend of hers who lived in Sosnovy Bor, one of Russia's still-closed cities, her friend having never met a foreigner or heard a native English speaker. Simple, I thought, as I accepted, and was soon placed on a very staticky phone connection to Katrina. After my initial greeting in English, and after a few halting phrases in atrocious Russian, I had nothing more to say and hoped that was sufficient. But Katrina was not saying das vidanya, goodbye. The faint, empty hiss and crackling of the phone tore at my ears as I pictured this young woman waiting expectantly on the other end. She, ostensibly in jail, a closed city walled off to the rest of the world, a young girl in prison for no crime other than being born. And me, the privileged Westerner, a supposed citizen diplomat who had arrogantly not taken the time to learn Russian, instead depending on the Russians learning English. And then Svetlana saved me, though I didn't deserve saving, by handing me a book. Amazingly, the poetry of John Keats, and better yet, in English. "Przyjalta, read, please," Katrina asked me. And so I read, and read, as if to a lover. "Bright star, would I steadfast as thou art, not in lone splendor hung aloft that night, and watching with eternal lids apart?" And each time I paused, Katrina would cry, "Da, da, more." I finished perhaps an hour and a half later, my Scottish friend also taking a turn. Katrina giggled her goodbyes, thanking us profusely from that isolated city by the Baltic Sea that I could only imagine. On the way home from Svetlana's that night, exhausted, jumbling along potholed streets of Novgorod in a rattling, gas-fume-filled taxi, I knew that I had much, much longer to go than just returning to my bed. I thought about how my seemingly simple questions about dinner had put Svetlana's parents through so much misery and stress. I thought about Katrina, how strong and hopeful she seemed, her hands stretching out between invisible prison bars, grasping for knowledge and connection. An infinitely more noble hunger than my base hunger earlier that day, worrying about my next meal. And I also thought how that night, I too had reached out a little further from between my own invisible prison bars, those of privilege, and in doing so, perhaps encountered a moment of true and lasting freedom. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Esther Cameron sees a connection between recent national events and the theme of today's show. The very existence of prison suggests a yearning for liberation. Cameron examines the conditions necessary to achieve freedom with order.
In the fall of 2001, someone asked Mary Carr, a professor at Syracuse University, to choose some poems for a reading about September 11th. She chose, among others, Paul Celan's "There Was Earth in Them," a poem that harks back to Ceylon's experience in a forced labor camp, where the work consisted of digging. The poem depicts a world of compulsion and suffering where creation and communication are impossible. They did not grow wise, invented no song, thought up no kind of language. They dug. But by the end of the poem, the digging has become a metaphor for an effort of communication in the present. Oh, someone, oh, no one, oh, no one, oh, you, where did it go when there was nowhere to go? Oh, you dig, and I dig my way toward you, and on our fingers awakens the ring. The ring. These days we think of Tolkien's one ring to rule them all, one ring to bind them. The ring as token of subjection to the Dark Lord. Recent liberation movements have tended to play off liberation against commitment and structure. But could there be a ring that liberates? Unless we are bound together by commitments, by covenants, each is at the mercy of an impersonal system, in a great prison that can, as we have seen, collapse on us. In that oldest liberation story, the exodus from Egypt intertwines with the giving of the law, which the rabbis compare to a marriage. And I am still hoping we could begin to think about the law again, not as a prison, but as something we may need in order to stay out of prison.
Fellow human, you are marching on the road to God knows where. There are chains upon your ankles, and your head is shaven bare. Will you put your mind to planning against the man behind the line, who still swings the whip and drives us on the downward track of time? Fellow humans, can you hear me? Does this ring some kind of bell? I have seen us from a distance, outside our self-created hell. There's a way if we can find it. There's a law no man has made that could link our minds together, help our hearts be unafraid. People, let us speak together. Tell each other all we know. We can build the town of wisdom that shall have no earthly foe. Pass the word on to your neighbor till one thought in every brain. The city we inhabit at the breaking of the chain.
I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
This is Doing Time on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up in the next part of our show, we'll examine the constraints that a life of art places upon those who choose that path, and move back in time to the England of Henry VI. I'm Greg Willard. We'll be back in a moment. Stick around, won't you? Jail needn't be state-supervised incarceration. It can also be self-imposed by the lifestyle we choose. That's the view of poet Sharon Van Sluice.
At the last Northeastern University where I taught poetry, I was hired to replace a rather conservative retiring established poet well regarded for his work in prosody. I was happy to get the job, as jobs for poets are few. However, within the first week of teaching, at least two of my new colleagues commented that they had expected me to dress more flamboyantly, more gypsy-like. I wore what I always wore to teach, the women's equivalent of Brooks Brothers suits. Apparently, it was generally expected that because many of my poems were not composed in strict metrical form, I would be a wild, free spirit who would wear gypsy skirts and comb her hair only slightly, or perhaps dress entirely in black and smoke thin cigars. No one asked me, though they may have wanted to, if I might also be an alcoholic, a heroin addict, a socialist, a manic depressive, or prone to suicidal thoughts. Those characteristics, too, people tend to stick to the idea of artist. Artists are sensitive souls, outsiders or rebels, or just weirdos who can't hold a job. That's the message from the outside. They are ideas that can imprison an artist, though most are able to ignore them and do their work. But the internal messages many artists give themselves can be a more constrictive prison, as they also contain a seed of truth. That is, that art requires constant sacrifice, and that a normal life may not be possible if one takes art seriously. And what seriously means, in the details, is that I may not have a secure career, may not marry or have a stable, loving relationship, may not have children or the whole host of other normal comforts to fall back on if things get difficult as I pursue my art. Serious means that I do my art believing that I actually have something crucial and universal, not simply personal, to say to the world, and that I also believe I have not only the talent, but the discipline and the will to draw up into consciousness and communicate clearly what others may only mutely sense to be true. The inner message of the artist, especially hard for those who find themselves blocked or sense they are failing, that inner requirement of the artist is the abandonment of what the great Greek writer Nikos Kazantzakis portrayed as the last temptation of Christ. The desire to live the normal life, to be a comfortable nobody, to live life just like everybody else. This poem is about an artist I knew who fell to the power of his own inner message about the cost of his failure. It begins with a rather pointed epigraph by Samuel Beckett. To be an artist is to fail as no other dare fail. That failure is his world, and to shrink from it, desertion, arts and crafts, good housekeeping, living. Photo of you, David in background. It is black and white, Firenze, September. I'd ask you to pose in the careful light of the Accademia. No flash, I was so artistic. You in your constant black against the impossible whiteness and praxitilian lines. It is not grief that draws me back. You were so decisive, no one could call it tragedy, no sad and freakish slip of the mind. It was your alternate path, your secret black capsule, a plan B I had never guessed or seen. In time, I sorted the pieces and pieced it back, a keen eye for signs of gravest intention, the signs you made and followed, quick and sudden, out of your one and only life. On the left and out of focus, the museum guard, one dark arm and the leg of her folding chair. I recall she hooked you with a hostile stare. Her fierce eyes dogged you. I thought it odd, misplaced, a moody artist, innocuous you. But I see now she knew, trained to catch the twitch that betrays a mind set on violence. She tensed, ready for yet another failed, crazy man with a hammer, craving the perverse immortality to be earned in some monstrous unmaking. And you, with no dangling camera, no tattered map, no rapt look of awe in this hall of the noumena, she pegged you in partibus. She caught the faint whiff of it, some bad intention, and stiffly watched. You were no danger. It would be weeks later, and then alone, discreet, a rented room, an exercise in neatness. I saw nothing and blithely snapped this abstract pattern in black and white. How clear it is now, in that fixed moment, your body closed in, turning to stone, rigid against the sublime curve of the perfect ankle and the perfect calf, line of the David, giant, ideal, and self-supporting, and here, ironic, the huge anagogical hand stopped in time, stopped in its inevitable motion towards glory, hand you had seen in 100 places, hand of the Sistine, hand of Adam, hand of the Maker, immortal above you. And here beneath it, your small face caught in paper and light, and the look you had worn from Bruges to Milano through 1,000 hard miles of merciless art. How clear it is now, the density of your sorrow and its direction, palpable and massive around you like the stone arch of a dark doorway, the ragged raven of your past, and all your possible futures as failure shadowing you. Doppelganger, grim angel, incubus. It is small in my hand, my last photo of you. And it is not grief that brings me to say this. It is the days, my own slow and ordinary days that continue incredibly on. It is my knowing now. If I could have known how, you would weasel free of that sharp threat of long life as no one. I would take you, shake you hard, and in all ways I know, show you, tell you, it is this, this, and only this, the wild and physical house of your life, its necessary keeping, the art of it, the craft of it, the precious and terrible living of it. This is Sharon Vansluis for Mind's Eye Radio.
When youthful offenders find themselves facing punishment and rehabilitation, we're saddened for both the lost human potential of the offenders and for their victims. But there is a third group of wounded in this tragedy of juvenile crime. Kathy Miner looks at these often forgotten casualties in her poem, Two Women in the Same Place.
I've seen the criminal justice system from more perspectives than I wish I had. This poem is based on personal observations at the City County Building in Madison, Wisconsin. You need to know that juvie is street slang for the juvenile reception center, or some might say juvenile hall. Two women in the same place, or the mothers, them others. One collapses, sobbing, on the hideous, grimy couch outside the rooms where hearings are held, but no one listens. She knows that her family will pass one son's birthday while his brother sits in jail. She cries there a long time, her heart leaking onto the lime-green vinyl and her grief thickening the air. But not one person, not one human being of all who pass by, stops to offer any help, any sympathy, a glass of cool water, any attention at all. This is juvie. Nobody notices the mothers. The other shuffles blindly down the sidewalk outside the same building, coat open to the January cold, and younger children trailing behind her. She does her weeping silently, tears taking their salty journey down her face, falling free when they reach her chin. She also has a son locked away from her. She makes eye contact with no one, asks no one for assistance, and everyone obliges. If any even wonder why she cries, it does not show. This is juvie. Nobody notices the mothers. This is Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio.
For centuries, iron bars have been a symbol of the prison experience. Fran Rawl was inspired by her visit to the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, England, where an unusual gift from the iron rights of the realm to their future king is displayed.
The Iron Cradle of Henry VI. I feel the bars through all the down the realm can hold. Asleep in my gown and crown, my infant dreams are old. Iron rockers grate upon stone as cold flows through to cold. This is Fran Rawl reading for Mind's Eye Radio.
Thanks for listening to Doing Time on Mind's Eye Radio. Our show comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin. Kelly Warren is our producer with help from Dick Radke. Contributors to our show include Esther Cameron, Kathy Miner, Norma Gay Pruitt, Dick Radke, Fran Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Sue Renard, Evie Thompson, Paul Thompson, Geither Valtzen, Sharon Van Sluis, and Carrie Wire. Original music by Barbara Chusett. If you'd like a copy of this show or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-256-6525 or log on to our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. We welcome your comments on this and other Mind's Eye shows. Send your comments to www.mindseyeaudio.com. I'm your host, Greg Willard, leaving you with the words from 17th century poet Richard Lovelace. Stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. Minds innocent and quiet take, that for a hermitage. If I have freedom in my love, and in my soul I am free, angels alone that soar above enjoy such liberty. Until next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.